Lorraine, Vienna in the late 19th century was the heir to the most extraordinary musical tradition. I mean, you've only got to think of Beethoven and Schubert and Mozart. But at the end of the century, there was extraordinary kind of cultural hothouse of music and immense innovation and a great gathering of people from all over the Habsburg Empire. Mm. Who stands out for you in this great hothouse of music? I presume it's Mahler, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, at that period, the turn of the 20th century, there's no doubt that he was the master. He ruled supreme. He was the head of the Royal Opera. He had supreme power there. He had power over all aspects of production. So he wasn't just the conductor.
Mm.
He looked at the set design, he looked at choreography, dramatisation, all of that. Mm. And he made some major changes. He was the master, but of course you've also got Schoenberg. Mahler was a great champion of Schoenberg. There are some wonderful stories about him at concerts where people were booing and hissing and stamping out and banging doors.
And there's great cartoons about that, aren't there, of mayhem occurring.
Absolutely. And Mahler would stand up and he would browbeat the audience into being quiet. So they were very good friends. And, of course, Schoenberg, he had married Zemlinsky's sister, Matilda. So there was a little group of them there that were, you know, really very, very close.
It was almost a kinship, yes.
Absolutely. Mm. But then, of course, you know that when you read many of the great writers on this period, the musicologists, they talk about Vienna as being, at that time, the bastion of conservatism, while at the same time being the birthplace of the most radical new ideas in music history, and that is Schoenberg and the 12-tone school.
Mm.
It blew apart everything they'd ever known. And, you know, I mean, in terms of that conservatism, you're wheeling up to the end of the Romantic period here. It got to the point where harmony was so overblown. It was like the use of dissonance was enormous in that it was unresolved, which was a no-no back in the classical period. Mm-hmm. You have things like progressive harmony where a composer would start in one key and finish in another so you didn't know where you were.
Mm.
And that was not, you know, the way the classicists saw it. So there was an enormous explosion of the use of dissonance and they're reaching for what, you know, where can we go next? And in a way, you can think of Schoenberg as a reaction against that overblownness. But Mahler was the man. He was in Vienna as the head of the opera from 1897.
Yes, the same year as the secession.
1907.
Yes.
And of course, the secession. Mahler had entree into that whole artistic scene via Elmer, whom he married in 1902.
Mm.
And of course, you've got Freud.
Yes.
He's there. You've got all the writers, the philosophers.
Yes.
But musically, if you follow that through, it's quite amazing to see the progression through all of those composers.
Mm.
Brahms was teaching at the conservatorium when Mahler went there in 1875.
Yes.
And he wanted to learn from Brahms. I don't think he ever did. I don't think Brahms was ever one of his teachers.
But didn't he used to go and visit Brahms in his country house?
He did. Brahms was not convinced about Mahler as a composer.
Right.
And I think that hurt Mahler a lot because he wanted to be recognised as a composer. In his lifetime, he was. In fact, he once said, and I think this is so telling, Richard Strauss's time is now. My time will come.
That's right. Yes,
you know, I do recall
reading that, yes.
So he recognised that he would not be accepted in his own time. And it's interesting that it wouldn't have been until the 1950s, 1960s that suddenly
it
started to, the groundswell started, and now people can't get enough of him.